Well, today on our Tech for Business podcast, Nate, our Director of Cybersecurity and BCSO, and August, our SOC Analyst, are joined by Colin, the Senior Solutions Engineer, and Brett, the Customer Success Manager from ThreatLocker. So I'm going to start with just thanking both of you for coming on, taking the time being here. We got quite a crew.
Thanks for having us.
Yeah.
Thank you.
So, I know Nate, actually, if you watch some of our other podcasts, ThreatLocker has come up. We've talked about you guys. We really wanted to get you on the podcast. I'm going to throw it to Nate to kind of describe a little bit of the relationship with CIT and ThreatLocker and kind of give us a little opener.
Yeah, this is a really strong partnership that CIT has with ThreatLocker, and it plays a very strategic role within the initiatives that we're doing for our customers today. Is if you know CIT or you've been around CIT for a while, you've seen that we've done a lot of security pushes over the last couple of years at least. And this is a differentiator, right? Is a lot of small MSPs today are doing a lot of break fix. And then, you know, an MSP will typically move into more of a proactive, you know, still IT over management component. You know, hey, we've seen some alerts about the network activity. Then we start to see MSPs start looking at, okay, well, now we need to put in security tools to detect and respond to security threats that are in the environment. And from other podcasts in the past, we've talked about the NIST cybersecurity framework. We've talked a little bit about the cyber defense matrix. But when you were talking about those, we see that the first few pillars to be able to secure your environments is identify, protect, and then it's detect, respond, and recover. But a lot of the security tools that MSPs are providing today fall more into the detect and respond. And the problem with that is that those are all post-security incidents. No one wants a security incident in the first place, and now we're relying on tools to be able to respond to that. So what CIT has really taken a lot of initiative and focus on is shifting that mentality and focusing far, far heavier on the identification and the prevention capabilities of your security tool set, because we are trying to ensure that you don't have a security incident in the first place. Now, ThreatLocker, we've looked at this for years at this point. We've internally used it for years. I've been rolling it out to our customers for less than that, but still a while. And we have seen a lot of success of preventing malicious software even before it hits potentially your antivirus or EDR solutions. And then the capabilities of ThreatLocker has only evolved far, far greater. I think you guys have some of the fastest dev teams I've ever seen. So I'll let you guys get into that. But that's the reason why CIT has partnered so heavily with ThreatLocker. Again, we're trying to prevent you from ever having a security incident because it's business disruptful. And there's a lot of, again, as we see the industries starting to shift to, you know, increased breach notification requirements and everything like that, heavier penalties of security incidents, we're trying to shift the culture, right? So that was a long-winded way of saying this is a great partnership.
Yeah.
And there's a very, very important reason why we've done this for all of our customers.
For sure. So, Colin, maybe you can talk to us a little bit. Like Nate mentioned, we've had plenty of podcasts in the past about cybersecurity. We just did a large zero trust maturity model series. Right. Can you give us high level of ThreatLocker's kind of role in that and kind of the solutions and the benefits that businesses are getting from ThreatLocker? And then we can kind of deep dive. Yeah.
Yeah, and funny enough, we get to start with the zero trust conversation at the very beginning, the buzzword in all its glory and what it really means to you guys. Now, you've dove into this topic on previous podcasts, but I love to give you my two cents here, because in my role, I think it's really important to kind of bring that back to earth. There's a lot of ways to describe it, but in essence, I wholeheartedly believe it's just least privilege. Everyone in the business has a role. Everyone has access to the things that they need, and just keeping that to the people and the tools that need it. And we get to build on that in a much broader framework. So when I describe Zero Trust, it's the ideology of being least privileged, but at scale in all the layers that make sense. So where ThreatLocker gets to step in, because going back to this idea of Zero Trust, it's not just one tool, one piece of software that accomplishes this. It's a change in mindset, a big change in culture as well, because it goes from being able to freely just run things to making sure that if there's software, if there's anything foreign touching your machine, your network at all, someone knows about it and has allowed that to happen. So a lot of times when we kind of do our maturity levels, we go from a conversation of, instead of just having alarm systems on your home, as an example, you have locks on the door for that very reason. So as a business, at all times, you should know what's going in and out, not just physically, but at any level, you should have visibility and control of that. And that's where we get to fit in. We are really tasked with hitting the layers that make sense, what's running, who's touching it, what software can actually have access to the important things. And that's where we get to make a big difference. And then digging into that, there's a couple different components of what we do and how the software functions. But the most important thing that has actually brought us into the security conversation at all is application whitelisting, application control. And we'll start there. Because fundamentally, Zero Trust says, yep, if there's software running on the machines, someone on the team knows about that, and it's approved. And what ThreatLocker gets to do, I always like to tell people to visualize us as being in the middle of the supply chain. So think of instances of like SolarWinds Orion, Kaseya VSA. You have these tools that you trust that should run at some level, they belong there. But because of how we work, the relationships we have with those vendors, those developers, we get to vet their updates, their changes before they hit the general space. So more often than not, you have an understanding of what should be inside of the environment to begin with. On the flip side of that, you go back to the difference between Zero Trust and like detection and just purely responding. In that essence, we're not waiting until something bad happens to take an action. We deny it at the very front door. And that's really the shift in perspective. We can control what comes in and out of the home, essentially. And as we kind of work with Nate, August, and the team, I typically would say the idea behind approaching Zero Trust is that change in culture. You think about the differences between large enterprises and SMBs, and that's it, purely. It's more of a requirement for a large enterprise, which makes that really simple. But what we've noticed in the SMB space, you think back to the last insurance audit you may have done, those questionnaires are there for that very reason. And at some points in time, if you can fulfill all those requirements, you even get cheaper premiums and you're incentivized that way. But not just luckily for us, luckily for the sanity of just how we handle security in this space altogether, those requirements are coming closer and closer to SMB as the days go on. So you think of dealerships, car dealerships. As of last year, they're all treated like banks for that very reason. So you get some of those components where it starts to immediately be more relevant, but the big conversation is culture. And what can we do to kind of address the culture of security in SMB and not just make it more relevant, but make it very simple to understand and kind of move forward with? So yeah, right from there, that's how we kind of fit in and help with the team.
Yeah, Colin, I think you kind of touched on a couple of things that I just want to expand on a little bit was, you know, especially the conversation that you just had about, or what you just meant about the dealerships are now treated as banks. So for those that haven't been keeping up on the regulations, you know, the FTC, they pushed out saying if you're going to do business with things like GM, Ford, you know, anyone like that, you have to adhere to the same standards, right? And those are very difficult requirements. And so we see a lot of these small car dealerships coming in saying, I have to go spend almost $100,000 a year just to be able to get to the same regulations to do this. just for the sake of conversation, since you mentioned car dealerships, and Colin, you had also mentioned supply chain. The news just broke, you know, with it this week, saying there's thousands and thousands of car dealerships that are currently down right now. And it's all because they were using some software in their environments, and that vendor had a malicious piece of software come in through that core application, and the dealerships are now impacted. And so those are the things where ThreatLocker steps in and says, okay, if there's a change to that software, we can prevent that from running. And I know, Colin, when I think it was SolarWinds, is the customers weren't impacted by SolarWinds because that wasn't a signed DLL, right? Exactly. So it stopped that threat and protected the supply chain. And so the culture change is sometimes difficult, right? And it does require that executive buy-in to be able to deploy this type of solution. Is the impact difficult? Not really. And so I can maybe hand it over to August to talk a little bit about, you know, how do you roll this out? And, you know, how do we know that it's not going to be impactful when we actually get to that point? But the implications of having a supply chain risk, like, again, we currently see with all these dealerships that are down, is massive. And it is something where these tools and ThreatLocker, this is one of their main differentiators, is they make it easy to deploy, which is if you know anything about application whitelisting, is actually kind of a nightmare with the other tools out there. So August, when we're deploying ThreatLocker, how are we able to work with ThreatLocker and you know, use the features of the tool to quickly roll it out, prevent the impact, and kind of ensure that we're not going to bring businesses down trying to implement something like this?
Yeah. How we deploy it basically is we push ThreatLocker to all the agents via our RMM script. And then what ThreatLocker does is it sits on the agent for its initial learning period, or before the learning period. It takes a baseline scan of the computer of like what's already on there, all the files, and catalogs it based off hash and builds an exclusion list within ThreatLocker portal of basically everything that's running on your system, allowing those executables, those DLLs that's already currently on your system. Then after kind of the initial learning period, reviewing everything that's still quote unquote denied, since the tool is not technically on, they use the term simulated deny. So we're able to, before turning on the tool, basically just review what would ThreatLocker have taken action on had the tool have been on, and then build custom policies based on that. So for example, like if a DLL gets blocked or denied, I should say, we can click into that and see more details. That ThreatLocker really provides like really in-depth details. So they have the full path of what was denied, as well as the calling process. So if, let's just say if like Citrix called a DLL, we'd be able to see like, okay, this Citrix executable called this DLL. That's a pretty normal process. So we can build a exclusion based off that, and then also dynamically change what's allowed, saying, okay, any DLL that's created or called to by Citrix is allowed to run. And that's just one example. We can also use created by, another one, same thing with Citrix. If it creates the DLL, we're able to allow that to run, or if it's signed, which is my favorite method, is to create an exclusion based on signature, just because that's just a little bit more secure in my perspective, as well as granular of, okay, I know this is coming from this specific organization's dev team, and this DLL is assigned to, like, they created this. So being able to run through those lists and create those future-proof exclusions is what makes ThreatLocker the biggest, or has the biggest advantage. And then after that, you know, starting with a small test group of devices and seeing how ThreatLocker handles those exclusions, and then going full scale after that, I would say is the kind of the whole deployment process, as well as also reviewing kind of like ThreatLocker introduced a health report, basically cataloging every application it sees in your environment and basically taking what does it do, what are the vulnerabilities that are associated with it, what's the country of origin that that application was created, and then it assigns it a risk score. So we can go through everything that ThreatLocker sees and say, oh, this has a 9. We should probably go review if that application is necessary in your environment. And then if not, create a permit or deny policy based off that. So we can get really granular in how the tool and deployment scale works.
Yeah, the ability to see those simulated denies is really what sets it apart. You know, if people are used to things like Microsoft AppLocker, all that type of stuff, the reporting is difficult, right? And that's where we see IT admins tend to open up too many holes when they're trying to build out those allow policies, because maybe someone's blocked, but the, you know, reporting or anything like that, can't see it in a centralized portal. Maybe you have to go to the endpoint to see those logs. Maybe there's a long delay between if you can actually get those logs to a centralized location. ThreatLocker, again, it's constantly feeding all the data back up to the cloud. And so we're able to see those results almost real time, right? And so then at that point, we can really get granular into the troubleshooting. I like to say that the ability to see the simulated denies is kind of like looking into the future. It's like a superpower, right? That's what prevents you from having impact to the business when you're trying to implement this granular of security controls.
Right.
I rolled it out here at CIT, and I had it deployed for, I think, 2 years at the time. And I told the salesperson, yeah, you have ThreatLocker on your device. And I said, I do. They didn't even notice because nothing stopped them for 2 years. So,
I know to speak to that, that's one of the expectations we always like to make really clear. It's still business as usual, especially with how we review. If you're I'll be honest and say the idea of difficulty between an enterprise, mid-size level business and a smaller scale business, for the most part, we're all using cloud tools. It's the offices of the world, the simple things. And one of the things we do a little bit differently is the management of those changes. We actually take over ourselves. So we have this terminology called built-in applications. So really simple. If Google Chrome decided to update right this very second, our team would have already seen those changes. So for the most part, it's the lift is there. The internal app team takes care of those changes at that level. And what myself and August get to do, if you're more of a niche type of business or you're using niche tools, maybe something was just built for your company and your company alone, it gives us an opportunity to really make sure the policies we're creating make sense ahead of time. So no, it is kind of a superpower, like you mentioned, seeing a little bit into the future there so we can avoid it. Because I'll be frank, I know no one likes tickets. I don't want to give you guys tickets. We don't want any tickets. So we try our best to make sure on the initial rollout, things are as smooth as possible.
Yeah, and I wanted to touch as well of like where ThreatLocker comes into play during that deployment process of, like Colin said, creating some of those niche applications and exclusions. Colin's been huge in helping with some of the pain points. I would say the big one has been developers, but it also is also kind of the partnership of helping out with making sure your company standard is kind of where it should, because we've dealt with customers where developers work out of multiple different folders instead of having one parent folder and running all of their applications through there, where it's, okay, you have 10 developers, all have 10 different file paths. Now we're doubling or I should say tenfolding our process of creating exclusions along there. So that relationship where Colin's able to kind of help guide us and as well as the customer into making better standardization processes for us and our customers. So,
Colin, you had mentioned a little bit about the built-in applications. That's a pretty, you glossed over it to a degree, but that's a major, major differentiator when it comes to the support and the uplift and management of a tool like this. Now, again, if you're listening, CIT, this is a managed solution, right? We have the full team. We partner deeply, deeply, deeply with ThreatLocker on all of this. We don't just take the tool and say good luck, right? But either Brett or Colin, either one of you, I don't care, but do you guys want to touch a little bit about the, you know, like how many applications you're actually tracking and keeping updates on, and maybe kind of the process of, okay, Microsoft Outlook, that's a giant application that everyone's using. How do I ensure that it's not going to be blocked, you know, the second that Microsoft pushes a new update?
Yeah, I can take a stab there. And it starts with what we call our applications team. So I think the most recent update I got, we were sitting around 4,800 built-in applications, which we'll expand on a little bit more. But it goes exactly like this. So Patch Tuesday comes around. And if you don't have this type of commodity, I really look at it as a commodity, the way we handle the changes. But you think of Office, not just Outlook, PowerPoint, Excel, but all of Office. If Microsoft pushes a patch on Patch Tuesday, guaranteed you're seeing around 30,000 to maybe 90,000 unique files that they push out into the wild. And every one of your machines will download that update for sure. So in the scale of that, what the built-ins offer is the cyber heroes, the portion of the team that I'm mentioning, their entire job, 24/7, 365, it is all they do. They maintain, track, and vet updates to all the tools that you're using, everything on that built-in application list. So it allows us to say, unlike, I don't want to pick on anyone, but you think of an app locker as an example, and I always poke fun at Microsoft in this way. If you lock down with something like that, I almost guarantee you Patch Tuesday comes around, you're turning that off to get the machines updated. What most tools don't cover are OS updates. So to break it down in this way, from server 2008 to current, from Windows 7 to current, all those updates and changes, not just to the third-party tools, but to the OS itself, is also tracked, vetted, and confirmed by us as well. So before those things reach general availability, that's why I kind of say picture us being in the middle of the supply chain, we get to make sure those things are accounted for. So I'll pick on one vendor here, and this is not my ThreatLocker speak, this is my engineer speak, because I was the person responsible for this. If you're using maybe a QuickBooks, a Sage, a Thomson Reuters, any financial tool, those updates happen very frequently. And you need rights. And we have the ability to say, not only are they allowed, but even when it's a daily update, you think around like tax season as things change so frequently, because we get to vet those changes before they're pushed out, your updates not only can run, but we can dynamically elevate your permissions for them. So you get to get back a lot of time and make things really simple that way. But yeah, those built-ins, they really do set us apart, because we get to see what's supposed to be there. I think one of my favorite examples of that and how it makes a direct impact when we speak to security, this idea of a zero-day attack, a zero-day compromise, what most of the space has been kind of cultured and taught is, again, we just have to respond very, very quickly. But if something bad can run, all it takes is one file. And that one file could be the difference between the entire business sinking versus it just being denied from the get-go. And you were kind of speaking to CDK. It's one of those things where even if we're saying that tool can run and we can allow it, what brought me to the team as an engineer, the real technical difference that brought me over here was this idea of saying, yes, your tools can run, but you should have actual control in what the software is allowed to do. You just think about the business. You have a financial tool. Why should anything other than the financial tool have access to financial data? You get to make things like that really straightforward. It's not a huge undertaking because we can see what's going on. But yeah, it's really simple. A lot of times we strive for like immutable storage, and that's where we should be. It's the end goal, but it takes a while to get there. So instead, what if you could just actually say the only thing that can touch sensitive data are the things that are supposed to? We get to worry about a whole lot less. And that's where the zero trust comes in. That's where that idea of least privilege comes in. It's the same scope. Well, same idea, I should say, just a broader scope. Nothing should touch data unless it's necessary. And that's the real conversation we get to have. We get to make sure that's the only thing happening.
You had touched on quite a few like subcomponents of ThreatLocker, like, because for those that are listening, we touch very, very heavily on application whitelisting, right? Because that is the bread and butter of locking down your environments, right? Nothing unknown can necessarily run. So therefore things like ransomware, right? You can't just blindly run in the environment. Now, one of the other challenges that we often see is IT admins granting users local admin because they don't want to have to always run to every device, always enter in their permissions, because we know that software does require elevated permissions to be able to run. And so Colin had mentioned this a little bit about some of those financial applications. And we see this oftentimes of certain healthcare applications always require admin. Banking core applications always require admin to be able to do their updates. And so now that also puts organizations in a kind of a bind, because the auditors are going to come through and say, don't add or don't give your users local admin. It's extremely dangerous, but the software needs to be able to run. So now you have to flood it with more IT resources just to go through and add all these personnel just to enter in passwords all day with their, you know, just to be able to support these updates. August, I'm going to hand it to you in a second to talk a little bit about how many ThreatLocker can do the elevation and, you know, with those applications. But then also, Colin, maybe if you wanted to follow up after that and talk about, while we're doing all these approvals and, you know, letting all the software run through, you guys also have the secure VM environment to be able to vet this stuff out before you're actually blindly approving it as well. So August, do you want to touch on why that application whitelisting, or sorry, that the privilege access management is so important? And then I'll let you, Colin, follow up with it.
Yeah, I think kind of the main point was having that one piece of software that is needed for updates. I'll just use, again, banking software, needing local admin to run an update. So it's taking, what ThreatLocker does is taking the ability to strip local admin from the user and apply it to one single application, which I think is absolutely huge. It's saying only bank software ABC is allowed to elevate if it's signed by, or run as local admin if it's signed by whatever, or whatever our rule set is. And being able to granularly control that, where we can either turn it on or turn it off, or make it silent, or make the users see that it's, you're running a program as a local admin. And assigning it to one single application, I think, is the like most important thing for that they have, aside from application whitelisting. And then they also additionally added the usage of, it's called elevation control, where now you can remove users from specific computers. So removing that, their admin account from that device, and kind of forcing them into that standard user with elevated permissions on one single application. So they kind of take it, the whole process of assigning the application with elevated rights, and then giving the ability to strip away their local admin profile. So I would say.
Yeah. So, and then I guess on my side of the house there, the last little bit on elevation, the idea of going to least privilege. This is where I always like to call out really the differences I see between enterprise and SMB. So when we deal with large enterprises, all the implementations and the deployments, I'll be frank, it's really straightforward because they have requirements that say this has to happen. So it just has to happen. But when we're in a situation where even if you're not dealing with immediate requirements, but you understand the security scope, the risk that's associated with everyone being admins, getting to that next step becomes really simple. So a lot of times before we take anything away, we get to make sure we give you the substitute ahead of time. And that's normally how we onboard. And the goal is to say, before we take your rights away and you can't run your updates on your own, we just give you the substitution. You still get an even easier transaction because it does it for you. But naturally speaking, before we take anything away, as far as permissions are concerned, we can clearly see how they're used. So it makes it really simple for us to even make the experience better. Just think, any time you've ever gotten a UAC prompt, every time it's popped up for some random component, random DLL, random part of Windows, that's something we have on record, and it's something we can build policies for. And it also works if the devices are offline. So your internet isn't working for some reason, the financial tool on the network still has to do its job. So you still get that capability, which is nice. And yeah, I guess the short-term memory is kicking in immediately. I was supposed to say something else, but oh, I wanted to piggyback off of August.
Yeah, no, you're good. I just wanted to talk about the VDI environment that you guys have, because that is also another one where we do see organizations where, you know, other PAM solutions, you just build the policy and say, I hope everything is secure, you know, that I've approved.
Right.
Now, what does it look like if there's updates? Or, you know, again, talking about supply chain changes, risk, right. How do we know if something that was pushed out is actually
legitimate
to actually approve? Right?
Right. And this is where I would say there's historically gray area when, again, we talk about zero trust. If something is coming from a vendor and you're used to trusting that vendor outright for everything that they push out, the idea behind zero trust is to say any node, anything that enters the network is vetted. And that is what that VDI that Nate is talking about allows us to do and do at scale. So all those built-in applications that we're mentioning, the 4,500 of them, as those updates and changes are being captured, they are automatically vetted because of that. So it does two things really well, in my opinion, and communicating security to everyone, again, changing the culture of security. One thing that had to be addressed is how the speed of change control. So something new comes in, we want to make it really simple for the tech staff, the security staff to look at what, to understand what they're seeing, know that it's good and allow it. And that should happen in minutes, not hours, not days, anything like that. It allows us to do it in real time. So even if the tool in question, the software in question, isn't something we manage, there's an infinite number of tools out there, software that gets created every day. So if it's unknown, and if it's unknown by everyone, we open up that gray area, that VDI, real time, whatever the file, the application is, it breaks it down. And any changes to the system, the network, any data is touched, it calls it out. It has this ability to track every single change being made to the virtual machine itself. So that does two things. Again, it makes the service delivery really, really transactional. Even if it's unknown, we can get everything captured in minutes about it, and it's approved. And it allows everyone, and this is the bigger technical win, in my opinion. When we talk about security, the personnel becomes important. And you'll go through the motions of having turnover. If there's new technical staff joining the team, if they're a little bit younger, greener in the field, and then you have everyone that's tenured. The goal of that VDI is to bridge the gap between the personnel there. Anyone should be able to see and understand exactly what's going on. And that's the beauty of it. It allows us to do both things. It makes change control very, very transactional, minutes. And it allows us to vet and make sure what we're doing makes sense at the same time. And that's the big difference, change control. And it's my favorite thing to really dig into a little bit more, because again, enterprise organizations, they have these notions already. When we're coming down to, I'll give you a better example. I was working on locking down a dental office, and this dental office just so happens to use Dentrix, which is, fun fact, one of the reasons why the PAM tool exists, the PAM tool that we offer. So the same partner, they were stuck in this interesting pickle where compliance, they were looking to get HIPAA and HITRUST. I don't know why they were doing both. I think one or the other would have been good enough, but they were gung-ho, which was nice. So that conundrum of not just having app control, but having the ability to manage permissions and tie that all together, it was a really, really direct win. But the barrier to entry was just the idea of change control itself. I want my browser extensions. No, absolutely not. Browser extensions are not good. Stay away from them. But it's those simple things that real in a lot of instances you may not have ever been used to requesting something like that, an add-on, something from the Microsoft store. But those are the entryways where all it takes, just that one malicious thing to be allowed to run, to execute, and the door is wide open at that point. So a lot of times I'll kind of double down on this idea of culture around change control. And I typically like to bring up my mom in this example, and it's really simple. As in the position I'm in, I think the weakest link in my own security posture is actually the people around me, right? Bringing it back home. My mom is about 75, 76 this year, and she's the most technically, no, inept isn't nice. I love her to death, but she just doesn't work with technology at all. So I fit in there. And some of the instances that I've noticed about how I could change, make her better, it actually is a failure of mine. And it comes back to culture. If I am this security engineer in my history, and I have these accolades and so on, if the people around me directly aren't as aware as I am, I wouldn't expect them to be to the T, but some level there, that's where the conversation starts, in my opinion. Being able to say, yep, you have a Mac. That is a Windows XP pop-up. Don't click that, please. That's where I think the idea of culture and around security really has to change. A lot of that starts at home. You look at your businesses, and yes, you want your business to be secure, but what if your business is secure? What if we deploy and we lock down and you're in a good spot, but you go home the same day, you plug your computer into the network, and the Minecraft bots on your kid's machine is trying to connect over. It's those simple things where if we're starting a conversation around culture, it really has to start with the people around you. Because to be fair, again, love my mom to death, but currently, she's the weakest link in my posture. If someone approached her, you know, the easy clickbaits, oh, we're Microsoft, click this link, let someone zoom in, remote in, that is still so real. And if you worry about that around, well, when it comes to the people around you, translating that to a business, your employees, changing the culture a little bit becomes a lot easier. That's something I wanted to pitch to you guys. How do you navigate that type of climate right now with loved ones, kids? But how do those conversations typically start or end at that level?
That's a good question. I mean, Nate, you have a wide variety of people, and I know you've done some training in the past. How would you?
I just take away their computers. So
the easiest way.
I've done enough help desk on PayPal compromises, all that type of stuff. I don't know how many times I fixed my grandma's computer when I was younger, but yeah, I wish I had something like this a long time ago for protecting them. But yeah, education is the biggest thing. So Colin, I think to your point was, if our loved ones have some type of security incident, it's a failure on our part to do our education, which is why I love the field of cybersecurity, because I'm on the podcast, I'm trying to do some education here, right? And so maybe I failed with grandma, but here we go. I can try and help someone else's grandma at this point, so.
I would say I'm at that same part, that same boat with you, Colin. My some of the things that my parents do, it's questionable of why are you running this software? Why are you not locking your computer when you haven't used it in 2 weeks? My mom actually was, she worked for one of our customers, so she was always a little bit intrigued and in more of that side, but as well as my brother-in-law also works for CIT here, so we kind of have a good start. But yeah, it's I would definitely agree with you, it's the people around you. So
yeah, and that's where I feel like the rest of it becomes a little bit simpler, and there's always a what I think is a fine line between how we position education and make sure we're not fear-mongering in any way. And that's something I always like to end with, because the reality is this. As of right this very second, there's around 50 ransomware gangs where it might take you 2 minutes to look at their drop site. And just to stress, there's no paywall here. And you'll know every single company that just kind of fails at the simple things. When we talk about security, and again, it's why I like to say, when we even mention zero trust, it's such a buzzword, but just deep down, it's least privileged. Who should have access to what? If we could accomplish that, then we're much better off. But when you hit these drop sites, you see who's really failed at that. It will give you such an eye-opening experience to know how many companies are just not thinking of security in that way, big enterprise, small businesses, and differently, but that's it. It can really just be one click. And it's, again, not meant to fear monger, but that's just the reality of how software works. It's all dynamic. The only other thing I typically like to mention to hopefully bring that concept home is you think about CIT as an organization. August, the rest of the technical staff, all the technicians, and how they operate. Just keep in mind, there is a group out there that is just as technical, just as skilled, and they're completely invested in not helping you. And that's the real parity of what we have to deal with. So when we speak on culture and we want to get these kind of things introduced, it's for that bigger picture. These ransomware gangs are legitimate. They're legitimate businesses. We just say gangs in that regard, but they are just as structured, just as technical. And that's essentially the opposition. So it's a constant battle there.
I think this is an interesting spot to stop. I would love to go in more detail about how much of IT and cybersecurity is about the people. You know, it's about the people that you're supporting. It's about the people that you're educating and helping and the people doing that. So it's a great place to kind of end today, I think. Thank you so much, Brett, Colin, Nate, and August for joining us today. If you'd like to know more about ThreatLocker or you want to get in touch with anyone on this podcast, please reach out to us at info@cit-net.com or head out to our website, cit-net.com/podcast. And we'll be back next week with an all-new episode.